you just tuned into the hippest way to start and grow your indie author career. Learn the ins, the outs, and all the all-arounds of self-publishing with the team from D2D and their industry-influencing guests. You're listening to Self-Publishing Insiders with Draft to Digital.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Self-Publishing Insiders. Oh, how we got an episode for you today. We are talking about Banned Book Week today. And we have a very special guest joining us, Lee Nguyen. Welcome to the show. I'm so happy to see you again.
Thanks. I'm really excited to be here, Jim.
And my friend and colleague, Lexi Green, is back in the studio with us for once again.
Always exciting to be here, Jim.
Always happy to have you, Lexi. So Lee, if you don't mind, I'm going to read your very impressive bio here because I want everyone to understand who you are and what your background is. It's so important.
Thank you.
Lee Nguyen is the Chief Content Officer for the Independent Book Publishers Association, or IBPA. He is an author who writes the books that would have changed his life as a young gay Jewish kid. His latest nonfiction book for readers 11 and up is The Gender Binary is a Big Lie. I've started to dive into it. I love it so far. I'm about a little bit less than halfway.
Thanks.
So Kirkus the Starred Review cheered it as an accessible, thorough, curiosity-provoking introduction to gender. His YA novels include the gay teen homage and critique of James Bond movies, and that's titled A Different Kind of Brave, that Kirkus called thrilling, positively thrilling. His picture books include Red and Green and Blue and White, illustrated by Paul O. Zielinski, that the New York Times praised as beautiful, and the Lambda Literary Award finalist, Love of the Half-Eaten Peach. Now, Lee was recently awarded BISG's Industry Champion Award. Congratulations, Lee.
Thank you.
For co-founding We Are Stronger Than Censorship, a program that buys and donates two books to offset every one book challenge. That's awesome. That's amazing. So welcome again, Lee. So happy to have you here.
Thank you. It's like a game. Can I hold up the books at the right time when you say the buy?
Honestly, the fact that you had all of them just so ready to go, that was a really cool spot.
Yeah, you're ahead of the game, Lee.
It's a fun problem, right? Like, oh, now I have, oh, well, coming out in a month, I have my eighth book coming out. So and my first book was actually crowdfunded. It was a book I published myself. So it's been a really fascinating journey. And the other seven books have been with indie publishers.
I don't remember. So when we first met back doing the IBPA conferences, going back, I want to say at least 10 years ago. When did you join IBPA?
I've been at IBPA for 8.5 years.
Okay. So. Was your first book published at that time?
I don't think it was.
I didn't think so.
No, this was 20. Well, I don't know. It's a math thing, right? Like, I crowdfunded Queer as a $5 Bill in, I think it came out in 2018. Okay. So, and actually, crazy story about me believing in indies and like the power of like the name of this, right? You said the freedom to read, the freedom to publish. Yeah. Wait, no, the freedom to publish, because you got to publish first and then they can read it, right? It's freedom to publish, the freedom to read. And yeah. I was saying that I think it's also about the power to publish and the power to read. And I've been on a very long journey to try to like get published, get traditionally published. And I really felt like I was being kind of like stonewalled. And I thought, well, maybe my books are too queer. Maybe it's just like, I just can't find the right champions. And my first book that I sold was this book, No Way They Were Gay. But I didn't sell it to this publisher. I sold it to a corporate publisher. Well, actually to an imprint of a corporate publisher. Sorry, I need to back up for a second. I'm gay. And I was closeted because I didn't know anybody else was like a gay person in the history of the world. And I didn't come out until I was 25. So okay. I spent like 14 years in the closet. And then in my 20s, I started to like do things that I would have done as a teenager. And one of those things was I went to like a weekend summer camp kind of thing. And there were lectures and talks, and we, you know, braided bracelets and stuff. And anyway, one of the people there was talking about the letters that Abraham Lincoln sent Joshua Fry Speed that convinced him that Abraham was in love with Joshua. And I was like, that can't be true. I have a good education. I have a master's degree from Harvard. It wasn't in history, but like, still, like, how could I never have heard this? And I went to the library and I got out a book that included an appendix that had all the letters. And I read it and I became totally convinced that Abraham was in love with Joshua. And it blew my mind. And I was like, ooh, that would make such a cool novel. And then as I was doing this, you know, teen novel that was supposed to be this page turner about this closeted gay kid that discovers this secret about Abraham Lincoln and decides he's going to out Abraham Lincoln to change the world. And then it all blows up in a giant media firestorm. I just kept finding more and more evidence that Abraham really was in love with Joshua and that there was so much backing it up. And I was like, well, I can't shove all of it into this page turner thriller I'm trying to write. Yeah. So maybe there's a nonfiction book. And then I was like, I didn't really like history when I was a kid. I thought it was really boring. It was taught in a way that made me feel like nobody like me was ever included in history.
Right, it wasn't your history.
It wasn't my history. It was the history of like straight, white, rich people from Europe. And so I kind of was like, well, maybe what's more interesting than a book just about a nonfiction book for kids, not just about Abraham and Joshua, is sort of about the false facade of history. So what if it was a book about men who love men and women who loved women, people who love without regard to gender, and people who lived outside of the boundaries of gender across time and around our world? And that was No Way They Were Gay. That was the book that I sold to this imprint of one of the big corporate publishers. And then we worked on it for a year and a half. I was really excited. It was going to be my first book out in the world. Yeah. And then our current president was elected the first time, and they canceled the book 2 weeks later. Oh. And that was the hardest moment for me on the whole journey. And I was just like, it was so devastating. And I was just like, you know what? I have to stop waiting for permission.
Right.
This is bullshit. So I took the idea for the novel and I crowdfunded it. And I went on Kickstarter and I was like, hey, I want to write this novel. This I called it Queer as a $5 Bill because Abraham Lincoln is on the $5 bill. And queer as a $3 bill is an old-fashioned-y expression for like something too weird to be believed. So, and the idea was help me raise the money to donate hundreds of copies of this book to empower queer and allied teens. And that's what we did. It became like a one-for-one kind of thing. Like, you'll get a copy, but we're also going to donate a copy. Yeah. And that was how I got my first book published. And I have to say that, like, I don't love the term self-publishing. And at IBPA, we really don't use the term very much. We really say author publisher. Because if you're an author and you're publishing your own work, you have to put on your publisher hat and then hire a team of professionals
to do
all the other stuff, right? Like, if nobody's going to pay me to design the cover of their book, I have no business designing the cover of my own book. And let me tell you, I run a lot of the book marketing programs for IBPA, and we have about a third of our members are authors who publish their own work, author publishers. And then we have a lot of indie publishing companies that are smaller, and then we have a few hundred that are really big indie publishers. But it is really clear when somebody that doesn't know how to design a book cover has designed their own book cover because they thought they could get dangerous with it on Fiverr or with the new AI technology. And it's kind of like, you're not helping yourself. People spend 4 years on their book and making it the best they can do. And then they spend 10 minutes designing a terrible cover and they don't understand why their book doesn't succeed. So, I'll step back.
I just wanted to back up and just put a pin into something that you said earlier, Lee, because it really struck me emotionally, because you said that you were closeted until you were 25. Mm-hmm. And so here you are, you wrote this book. It's going along the pathway to become published because, I mean, imagine if you could be yourself, you know, from your early childhood and through your teens, and here you have this book where you're trying to educate young people, like, hey, like, look at what is the truth here. And then it gets canceled. It's so much more than just canceling the book. It's canceling an entire culture.
And I wanted to jump in because you mentioned like when you were growing up, you weren't hearing these stories. And then that's the same trend you're seeing where like when you were going to get this book released, but suddenly it became kind of culturally inconvenient for a major publisher to do so. And like, that's, I think, why we're such advocates for indie publishing, for author publishing, as you put it, because like you put this book out on Kickstarter and it has an audience. People wanted to see the book. They supported it. It is a book that that can be out in the world and find an audience, even if traditional publishing is going to say that this isn't a book that anyone wants to read or isn't a book that we can take a chance on. And I think that you write about lost queer history, and like there's a reason these things are lost. And it is that same reason of like the powers that be decide the stories that we hear, decide the stories that collectively become part of like our cultural consciousness. And I'm hoping honestly that this push for indie authorship, this kind of a surge of indies, opens that door. Like we're slowly kind of breaking down those gatekeepers where it's like, okay, if a big five publisher doesn't want to take a chance on this book, I'm still going to take a chance on it. I'm still going to find my readers. People still deserve to hear stories about themselves.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I feel like there's this thing. Yes, I love that, Alyssa. History as it's taught is boring because it was sanitized. Definitely the sanitization of history. I keep imagining, I don't know if you, like those old hotels where they would like put a little ribbon across the toilet seat that said like, you know, sanitized for your protection. I feel like that's
so
the
much
kind
better
of thing.
Seeing that, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting too, because so many of the indie publishers that we really admire were started with this mission of having voices that previously hadn't been given the opportunity to be published and heard, published. So like Just Us Books by Sherilyn Wade Hudson, Leon Lowe, Levine Corrido. There are a lot of these amazing indie publishers that have a mission. And I feel like if the people listening have a mission to get their work out, and it isn't just a self-aggrandizing thing, right? It isn't just about yourself. It's about you're wanting to get your books out because you have a perspective you want to share with the world. You have something you want to share with readers. I think that's really exciting and really interesting. And also the fact that at this point, consumers don't care. It is a rare consumer that is going to flip to the copyright page of a book to see who was the publisher. If, right? Like, I mean, I can tell you a book I read recently that I loved. I have no idea who published it. It doesn't matter to me. It
doesn't matter.
Right? But it's like, but the quality has to be there, right? Like it has to be amazing quality. And that's the great thing, that you can actually be a publisher. You can put on your publisher hat. You can hire a team of professionals and you can put out something that's indistinguishable in quality from the great stuff that's coming out from the big publishers. And honestly, some of the big publishers put out crappy books too. I mean, they put out some beautiful books, but like, you know, it's like you're building your sort of brand, you're building your sort of thing. And I think that is, that's really exciting.
Yes. And I want to just, if I can underscore one of your points there, Lee, and it's that as authors, as indie publishers, you have something that the big publishers will never have, and that is your unique individuality. Because as Lee just mentioned, those readers, they're not looking for a logo on the spine of that book. They're looking to interact and connect with the author. And if you could engage with your readers, that's just going to set you apart from so many others out there.
And that's actually kind of like just like your voice is your special sauce. And the way that you tell your stories, also you're building a community around the stories, the things you're passionate about. Again, I don't think it's building a community around you. I think it's about building a community about the things that you're passionate about, that you mm-hmm. share with other people. Like, I'm really excited about empowering young people and teens, especially with queer history, especially with social justice stories. Mm-hmm. Like, that's what gets me excited. So I, rather than it being about me, which feels totally awkward, I try to talk about like the things that I'm excited about. And that's a way that I can connect with my community and my audiences. And I think that works better, at least for me.
Yeah, absolutely right. You're absolutely
right. And
Alexi,
what do you think? You're the marketing. Well, you're both marketing, right? Like, yeah. it's easier, right, to talk about the thing you're passionate about rather than be like me.
Yeah, no, I feel like there is, especially in the scope of like the, you know, kind of big brand publishing, like there's a desire to stay safe, to stay on trends. And like, I've certainly heard authors who are like, well, I'll just like write on trend and I'll just write what's popular or what I think is going to sell. And I think honestly, like you're not going to, if it's not the thing you're passionate about, first of all, it's going to come through in your writing. But secondly, you're going to burn yourself out as an author. Like no one wants to just write things they're not interested in for their entire career. That's a recipe to kind of crash out as an author sometime down in your career. And like, you're not going to be the person who's most equipped to market a book that you're not excited about. So
books are a lot of work, right? I mean, if you're actually doing it, and look, we have to acknowledge there's going to be so much AI slop out there. There's already a lot of crappy books that get published. But how do you stand out, right? It's going to be like your human endeavor, your special thing that you're bringing to it. And I think that in combination with you building your community, that's really exciting. And also I'll point out that I know a lot of people personally that already have a platform and they're choosing to author publish because they're like, why would I give away so much of my money and my rights and my IP to a third party? I want to keep it. And you know, that makes a lot of sense for them.
Certainly. Hey, Lee, I want to kind of go back to your organization here.
Yeah.
We are stronger than censorship.org. So what was the turning point for you? When did you realize that, hey, book bans, it's not a new thing and it's not a passing fad. When did you decide that, you know, I need to do something about this? Was there a certain moment for you?
Yeah, it was a very personal moment. So there was that whole thing with that first book with No Way They Were Gay. And then when No Way They Were Gay finally got picked up by Lerner, which is an independent company that, and this is the book, and it's actually much better than it would have been with the other company. And they did it so cool. It's like, it looks like it's nonfiction as like history, empowering chocolate rather than, like, look, instead of footnotes, there are these fun, like, bubbles with arrows to explain things and lots of photos. And anyway, I'm really excited about it.
I have the ebook, so I'm glad that you show the pages. Cause I'm like, oh, these are like different, like, okay, that makes sense now.
The print's actually more fun than the ebook, I have to admit.
It looks like it.
But the thing about it is that this book, while it won a lot of awards and got on a lot of really nice lists, it also got on a lot of not so nice lists. It got challenged and banned quite a few times. And because of that, I met Dr. Taslin Magnuson. And Taslin works with PEN America and actually was the co-author of the new report by PEN America on book banning last year. And Jim, I think you have the link up to that report.
This is fascinating. Like I really encourage everybody to check this out. You're going to be like, what is happening?
Yeah, it's so interesting. So Taslin sort of holds the data on book banning in the US. And she also hosts these very sweet sort of like Zoom meetings for authors that are in the position that I was in, where your book is challenged or banned. And, you know, what do you do? How do you react? You know, just sort of like a support group almost.
Wow.
And she and I became friends. And over the course of a few months, we kept talking. And I just said, what bothers me is that it feels like we're always playing defense. The freedom to read side is always playing defense. And how do we go on the offense? What does offense even look like? So we were brainstorming about it. And she told me a story about one person in Wisconsin that challenged 444 books in their school district. And all the books were pulled from the shelves for 4 months while they were reviewed. And then at the end of that time, almost all the books went back on the shelf. But really, for those kids in those schools, like those books were banned for an entire semester. And we came up with this idea, well, what if we made the numbers work against the book banners? What if for every book challenged, we bought and donated 2 books to offset that challenge? And so like, if that person knew that in response to their challenging 444 books, 888 books were going to get purchased and donated, maybe it would slow their roll. like it felt like a little bit of like a punk rock way of pushing back against this.
I love
like,
it.
The insanity, like that person did not read 444 books.
I was just going to say the challenge, like what is required to challenge a book?
It's nothing.
We need to push at it from so many sides. And this problem is so big, we can all get a couple of hands on it and push, because it's about legislation. It's about, joining your local school board. It's about speaking out. It's about changing the rules on how people are allowed to challenge, like that they have to live in the district, that they have to have a kid at the school, that they have to have read the book and swear that they've read the book.
Wait, you have to have read the book? I mean, yeah, like, just going a little too far now, Lee.
I mean, it's so interesting, like for a country that is all about like, yes, freedom, independence, you know, individuality, the fact that we think that it's cool to like, look, I'm a parent, and definitely I had input into what my kiddo read when she was young. And I helped guide, and you know, sometimes she chose books that I wouldn't have thought were great, but like if it was too much for her, then she stopped reading it. Like she knew how to self-regulate, and I was there to be helpful. And I felt like that was part of my role as a parent. I want to help my kid figure it out. But I would never have been like, I don't want somebody else's kid to be exposed to something, because I have no standing in that. I'm not part of their family. What the hell? So the idea that these other people think that it's okay for them to say that nobody's child should be able to read a book about a queer family. Well, I mean, my husband and I, we have a daughter that's pretty offensive to me. Man. Like this whole idea, the whole Mahmoud versus Taylor case that just happened at the Supreme Court, where they made such a terrible decision saying that, you know, parents should be allowed to opt their kids out of being exposed to a very sweet picture book being read. It's so problematic because, and so ironic too, because the case was brought by someone who was Muslim. And, you know, the ability for them not to see that it's just going to be turned on them too, and that someone's going to object to a Muslim picture book being read and opt their kids out of that. And it's like, I think it's part of the aim is to destroy public education and to, you know, really isolate and create a big closet to push all us people that aren't, you know, straight, white, rich men, cisgender men, you know, everybody else, women, people of color, trans people, intersex people, like queer people, of, you know, black people, immigrants, everybody else. They just want to like, you know, take away any sense of identity, of understanding that we have a legacy. They're attacking mm-hmm. books, not even because of the content of the book. That's a huge myth. Okay. Like the biggest myth about banned books is that it's about the books. And if
I was just about to bring up this point, so
it's not
going
about the books. If you buy into their, it's like buying into their bad logic. They're going to say, oh, that book is pornographic, when it's a book with, you know, one man walking down the street with his arm around the other man's shoulder. I mean, I'm not making that up. They're saying that about these books. It's so crazy. It's not about the books. And don't argue about the specific book. I mean, you can if you want. I don't want to tell you what to do. But
well, you bring up an amazing point. Is that like, and not to get all like, you know, first they came for the socialists, but like it is the case that it's like if you start to concede this ground and they're like, oh, this is obscene, it's like, okay, maybe this one book is obscene, but like they're not gonna stop. Like the more you concede ground in this argument, the more that you try and meet them halfway, the more they're gonna move a halfway point. Because it's like, okay, like, oh, I think this is pornographic, okay, maybe like we'll take this off the shelves. Okay, they're gay people in this, I think that's, I don't like that, okay, we'll take that out. And then like it continues, like they've like, it's obviously some queer representation on this episode today, but like they've come after books about black history, about like, you know, like brown history, like women in history, like these topics, like you said, if anyone that fits outside of the people who are making the rules, they don't want that to be available. And the more ground you concede, the more they're going to keep taking. And I wanted to touch back on the woman who banned 400 books, because that's I want, it's so easy, I think, in 2025 to get nihilistic and to get kind of doomer, to fall into doomerism. And I, that is not uncommon. That is kind of the norm of people who are banning these books. It's like a very small group of people who are banning a very large number of books. And I think that it's important to not get defeatist, because these are this is an incredibly small percentage of the population that cares about this, that's pushing on this. And with organizations like yours, with people who are actually willing to like put in the work, get involved in politics, get involved in these conversations, you can push back. It can be very effective. I think like it might have been the Mahmoud case that was, you know, allowed people to opt their children out of LGBTQ like lesson at schools, and like out of thousands of kids, 43 parents, I think, maybe less than that, ended up opting their children out of that lesson. This is not the popular opinion, and it is worth pushing back, because we're not in the wrong. Like, it's giving the voices to people, not advocating for banning books, not advocating for getting these stories away from people and children. Like, that is the radical position, and it is the position that is something that we can fight against. So keep hope, like, be optimistic, and don't just give up the fight.
Yeah, and to back that up, Lexi, the Washington Post did a study a couple of years ago. They found that they analyzed over 1,000 book challenges, and they found that 60% of them were by 11 people. Wow. Like, I know 11 people. I mean, I bet we all know 11 people that can be on the side of the freedom to read. So I just want to go back for a second. Like, so why are they banning books if it's not about the books? They're banning.
Is it to protect the children?
It is not about the children. It is to create a chilling effect. It is right. To make teachers and librarians afraid to bring in books that have any diversity in them, because they're worried they're going to lose their jobs or they're going to get in trouble. And it's created this. And I have a really interesting perspective working at my day job for the nonprofit IBPA, because we hear from publishers, and we're hearing from some publishers that really focus on books about underserved and underrepresented communities, that their sales to schools and libraries are down 50%.
Yeah.
So that chilling effect, people are really afraid, and that it doesn't just impact the publishers and the authors. It goes all the way through the entire supply chain, ultimately hurting readers. Because look, one of the reasons I was closeted for 14 years from 11 to 25 was that I thought I was the only gay person on the planet. Mm-hmm. I think that's a harder thing for people to feel now because there is the internet, but like they are trying to make by making the books, by saying any book with gay representation is pornography, which is oftentimes the line they're taking, or is obscene, that is making people feel like there's something wrong with them, there's something wrong with their families. It's creating shame. It's trying to build that closet to push us all back into it. And hell no, we're not going back in the closet. And you know, we need to fight back. And, you know, I like the idea of like finding ways to go on the offense that are innovative and kind of creative, which is where the whole We Are Stronger Than Censorship thing came up. So like I'm wearing, the logo of, I don't know if you can see it on my t-shirt, but the big logo for what we're doing is, it includes a circle, that's the O, that's a do not enter sign. And the horizontal white bar that's usually in the do not enter sign is actually opening up to reveal it's a book being read. It's opening up the other way. So we have all these kinds of t-shirts and stuff. So when you buy a t-shirt, it includes a $16 donation to buy two books to offset one book challenge. And then
this is where you can get it, right?
The Bonfire store is where you can get it, but it's also available on the wearestrongerthancensorship.org website, where we also take donations. So you can donate $160, but lets us buy and donate 20 books to offset 10 book challenges. You know, if you're really wealthy, you could do more. If you know a billionaire, sure, let them do some good. You know what? It's kind of cool. We've been doing this for about a year now, and I just ran the numbers the other day, and we have raised enough money to offset 1,392 challenges.
Wow.
By being able to buy and donate 2,784 books. So like, I like my t-shirt. It says strong like a reader with that same circle on the back. It has the logo. I can't turn around because I'm tethered. But we have lots of other ones like strong like a teacher, strong like an author, strong like a librarian, strong like a writer, strong like a poet, strong like a memoirist. Truly, we have like 13 different designs. So that's really cool. And we're going to launch with Microcosm a line of stickers that's going to be sold in stores and stuff and also on their website. And it's going to have all of the same kind of cool slogans. And then every sticker is going to be like a dollar donation to the program. So every 16 stickers sold will be two books to offset one book challenge. And if you can't afford to do it, you can, you know, spread the word about it. I think the other thing that's really important is word of mouth. I think most of the people listening know that word of mouth is really the thing that sells books. So If you read a book that is by, you know, that would have been affected by the chilling effect, you know, get the word out, share about it. I'll share that the book that I read recently that I thought was amazing was I listened to the Pride and Prejudice sort of the new thing on the new audiobook for it. And then I was talking to a group of friends and I was saying, man, I wish there was like a queer version of Pride and Prejudice. And they're like, there is. And nice. It turns out there's a YA queer version of Pride and Prejudice called Most Ardently. And it's gorgeous. And I listened to the audiobook. It was amazing. And so yeah, there you go. That's how we spread the word about books. And I think that that's something really easy that people can do to sort of, you know, go on the offense, share about a book that is about an underrepresented community. And that's cool. And also challenge yourself to read a book that you wouldn't necessarily normally read.
Absolutely. Yeah, I want to bring up a quick comment here from Alyssa again. Perfect point. She says, it's so easy to put down a book. If it's got something in it you can't handle, it's as easy as setting it down and walking away.
Yeah, and this is the amazing, it's so well said. And it's also brings up that, you know, sometimes they've been saying like, well, we don't have to have the books in libraries because, well, someone who wants it can just go buy it. I think that that's like a lot of, there's a lot of privilege built into that expression. Like not everybody can afford to buy every book. And like Alyssa's saying, like sometimes you're not sure you're going to like a book. So I get it from the library and, you know, I can't afford to get every book I'm interested in to buy it. So yeah, sometimes I get a lot of times I get the books from the library, and if I really love it, then maybe I buy it too. And that's actually something that is good for people to know, that libraries are a great way for people to discover books. And there've actually been some studies done that show that libraries sell, like selling to a library leads to more sales, which is good because I think a lot of times people are like, well, I don't want, you know, I don't want 10 people to read it and me only get paid once. No, it's good.
Yeah. Libraries are sales engines that we, discovery engines.
Yeah.
If there's one thing readers love to do, it is talk about the books they are reading. And if you're getting your book into the hands of readers and making it more accessible, that's how word of mouth starts to get spread.
Yeah. Lee, I wanted to go back to your point just real quickly about the chilling effect that book bans have. Because if you look at some of the Pen America numbers just at face value, you can see that during the election year, 23-24, book bans, I think, were up above like 10,000. And then currently there's like down around 6,000, something like down around 6,000. Like it's
yeah. And down is actually not really the right verb.
That's what I'm getting to. So I don't want people to realize like, hey, things are getting better. It looks like this is getting better, because per your point with this chilling effect, libraries, schools, librarians are sort of self-censoring, aren't they?
Absolutely. They're not bringing the books in the first place. So yeah, there are fewer books to remove from the shelves because there's less books being brought in. There's less books being acquired in the first place. And this speaks to like the hoops that we have to jump through to make sure that it's not just us saying our books are good, right? Like when you work with a publisher, they have a reputation. And so that even when it's an indie, if it's a good indie, they have a good reputation and that helps you, but you still need to get reviews. I think it's really important, like, you know, for authors that are publishing their own work to get trade reviews if they can, to mm-hmm. submit to things like Forward Reviews, you know, to submit to things like Midwest Book Review, you know, that the handful of other trade publications that will consider editorial reviews of your book. And then I also think that you can look at things like the paid review services, Kirkus. You should probably be paying for a Kirkus review. They are brutal. Mm-hmm. And yet everyone really respects them. And it doesn't matter if it's a paid or unpaid review. The only people that can get unpaid Kirkus reviews are the trade, the big corporate publishers. So everybody else pays for a Kirkus review. So I think like get a Kirkus review. If it's a terrible review, you can kill it. But like, honestly, it can help. Even if they say some critical things, usually there's something great that you can share. You need to vet your books. And if you want to have librarians pick them up, there's also Clarion. There's also Publishers Weekly has Book Life. There mm-hmm. are a bunch of different, there's I think Blue Ink. IBPA offers a lot of discounts on things like review programs. And I definitely think it's worthwhile looking at those because in addition to, like you need somebody besides you to say your book is good. So that's where blurbs come in. And I know that there's been this big thing about corporate publishers, some of them saying, well, we're not going to do blurbs anymore. And it's like, well, they can get away with it because they're a corporate publisher. I think author publishers should be getting blurbs. I think it can't hurt to have somebody else that's in your field say, oh yeah, this was great. And then I think you should get trade reviews. And then, yeah, consumer reviews. We know that the algorithms shift on some of the platforms when you have a certain number of trade reviews. Of reader reviews, of consumer mm-hmm. reviews. So there are programs like NetGalley that help you get those reviews in a legit way that you're not buying the reviews. So I definitely think there are things people can do. I mean, honestly, I was told by one of my publishers that it was really problematic that on one of the big retail sites, I didn't have more reviews. And I don't send people to that retail site because I don't mm-hmm. like that retail site so much.
We're not going to ask you to mention which one it is.
Yeah, I'm sure people have no idea. I'm being so obscure.
It could be any retail site, you know, any big retail site that takes reviews.
So I send people to my local independent bookstore. I send them to their independent bookstore. I send them to bookshop.org. I don't link to bookshop.org. Yeah. I don't actually link to that retailer from my personal website. So I do nothing to get that there. And then they came to me and they said, hey, we want to do a BookBub deal for your book, but we can't because you don't have 20 reader reviews on your page. And this is really problematic for us. Like it makes it look like nobody likes your book, but we know people are reading your book. You have to help us. So I spent a weekend and I texted, I think over 70 people. And I was like, hey, could you please put a review? And this is actually important for people to understand. Like, I think when you ask someone to leave a reader review, they think that it's writing a book report. You don't need to summarize the plot. You don't need the it's already been done. The plot has been summarized. It's right there at the top. What you need is that like one sentence, you know, I thought this was great, or you know, this made my pulse race, or like just something made me cry. I loved it. Like it's that one little phrase. That's all you need to do. And I reached out to my network of people and I said, hey, I texted them and I was like, I need help. I need to get more reviews on this site. Otherwise I'm not going to have a sequel to this book. And I really want it to be a series. Help me out. I know you've already read the book. Help me out. Yeah. And we did, and we got over 50 reviews. So, and it wasn't just that, but it helped. I mean, again, it reminded me that like community is really, really important. And not just in a sort of like, I'm going to use them way, but right. I actually think like community is actually the antidote to all this sort of manufactured chaos and hate that we're experiencing right now.
And I bet that they really enjoyed helping you.
I mean, they were very sweet about it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I also told them don't say in the review, my dear friend Lee.
Yeah, paid me. Yeah.
No, I certainly didn't pay anyone, Mark. Even because they'll take it down. If your sister wants to post a review and says, my brother wrote this great book, they will take it down. Because they want it to be or the robots will take it down, whatever. They want it to be like it is someone that does not have a personal connection to you.
Before I forget, Lee, what do you say to the people who say, hey, your book was banned? Oh, you're so lucky. Did that help you out with your marketing?
Okay, that is really hysterical, Jim, because that is the next point I wanted to say, because I still get people that say, oh, congratulations. I'm like, oh, no, it's not congratulations. And in fact, it's interesting because this book, The Gender Binary is a Big Lie, was on that Department of Defense list, of banning the books from all their schools. It's been on a bunch of, it's gotten hit a few times now by challenges and bans. And every time it happens and I mention it to a friend that hasn't heard me say this yet, they go, oh, congratulations, that's going to help you sell so many more books. I'm like, it's actually not how it works. It actually, because of that chilling effect, it actually is just making it harder for this book to get out there. And like this book, actually both of these books were Junior Library Guild selections. So that's a cool thing that...
That is a cool thing.
It's like, you know, I think this book, it was like over 1,500 copies. I can't remember exactly how many, 1,600, 1,800 were purchased by that program to go to libraries.
Awesome.
So I knew that it was in a lot of libraries.
Yeah.
So again, like, you know, Lexi, like you were saying, like, it's not that this book has been challenged more than a handful of times, but some of those challenges affect all the books in that system. So like the Department of Defense is a great example. Like, I don't know how many of their schools had my book, but none of their schools are allowed to have it right now, which is crazy because it's like, you know, it's an award-winning book about actual history that's written for kids 11 and up. And the only thing it does is it challenges the patriarchy and sort of the current power structures.
And that's unfortunately the biggest sin you can make right now. You mentioned, you know, people like congratulating you for having a banned book. And like, I get where that thought process comes from, because like it, when you look at something that is happening that feels so stupid and counterintuitive to like sense, it feels like a badge of honor to be like, oh yeah, no, I'm one of the books that like people who suck want to take away from libraries. But like it, despite it being dumb, it is also incredibly dangerous. And like, we can't just pretend it's like, oh, like it's just like a joke thing and eventually just be like, there's real life consequences to this. And it's the reason why we can't just leave it alone and just assume that it will be a problem. Like, it will be a problem that just goes away on its own.
Right. And it's affecting all the books. I think that's the most important thing. Whether or not my book is on a list, it doesn't matter, because like my picture book about this, you know, inspired by this true love story from 2,500 years ago of two guys in love in pre-unified China, mm-hmm. like the sales of this book are being affected by the book banning that's going on, even though this book hasn't landed on any particular, you know, hit list. Maybe now it will because I just brought it up. But like, but it also was a finalist for the Lambda Literary Award. So there you go.
Congrats.
Thank you. Look, it's affecting all the books. And that's the thing that we need to push back about.
That's exactly what I just wanted to ask you about, Lee. I'm sorry to interject, but I think like some of us have a tendency to think, well, this is just happening like to the largest publishers and the books that they're putting out there. But no, this has a ripple effect on all of us, including indie titles, self-published titles out there.
But a note of hope is that it's not like the people that want these books have gone away, right? They're still out there. They're still really, really wanting books. And what's happening as the sort of they're throttling down on the availability of these books, I do think there's an opportunity for authors who are publishing themselves to create work and get it out there. Because the thing that the big corporate publishers I don't think they do a very good job of is branding and sort of like in terms of building their communities. They have too many books. It's like, it's too hard to sort of like, you know, be a defined thing. And that's why the branding often falls to authors. And so whether you're published by a corporate publisher or an indie publisher, or you're doing it yourself, a lot of the branding falls to you to sort of say like, this is what a book my kind of book is. Like on my email signature for my author site, for my author stuff, I say, like, you know, I write the books that to empower kids and teens to be their authentic selves and change the world. Like, that's my thing. And all my books sort of fall within that theme. And I feel like if you like one of my books, I mean, they're really different from each other, but like, you'll probably be in the groove on that. And then, you know, and that's not everybody's cup of tea. I think a lot about this quote from Anne Lamott in Bird by Bird. She talked about how lighthouses don't run all over an island looking for boats to save. They just stand there and they shine. And that really inspires me because, look, not everybody's going to like the light from my lighthouse, right? I feel like every book is another light on in the lighthouse. Every opportunity to talk like this is another light on in the lighthouse. Not everybody's going to be interested in that. And that's totally cool. But the people that are, I'm really excited to kind of like have them in the light and see their light too. And I think, like, you know, we get enough lighthouses going here, we can brighten up our world a little bit, which sorely needs it.
Yes. Yes, we do. I want to ask you, Lee, as we're coming toward the end of our session here, what message do you hope that our viewers and our listeners take away from We Are Stronger Than Censorship? And then how, maybe then how can they get involved?
Be your authentic self and help change the world and push back a little bit. Like, you can stand up. It doesn't have to be loud. It doesn't have to be, you know, aggressive. We can do little things and, you know, little enough of us doing it. I think a lot about a choir singing and how, if you've ever sung in a choir, you know, you cannot sustain a note forever. You are going to need to take a breath. And as we're pushing and fighting for the freedom to read and all these other sort of, you know, rights that are being challenged in our society today, recognize that, like, sometimes you can take a breath, you can take a day off, you can stop looking at your social media and know that other people are singing and sustaining the note. And then when you're refreshed, you come back and then you sing and then other people can take a break. I think that's really important. Again, I really believe community is the way that we do this. And We Are Stronger Than Censorship is premised on that. Like, I don't think that there's going to be some billionaire that's going to come along and write a check for $160,000 and suddenly we'll be able to, you know, have all these books out there in the world because of that one act of largesse. I think it's going to be because we sell thousands of t-shirts. We get, you know, hundreds of people writing checks for $160. We sell, I don't know, a million stickers. Like, I think that's how we're going to do it, by you know, by a community coming together. And when you talk to people out in the world, generally, they really do believe in the freedom to read. They think it is one of the fundamental freedoms, you know, First Amendment freedom. And I think that it's important to recognize that your voice may be your special sauce. Like, your books, the ones that you want to put out in the world, that's your special thing that you can do to try to push back and make our world a better place. And that's what I think about when I sit down to write. And I hope that people listening to this know that, like, the story that you can tell, that only you can tell, that is important. And I hope you get it out there and join the fight for the freedom to read.
I love that. I love that. Lexi, did you want, I look like you're just about to say something.
Okay. No, I mean, he said it beautifully. Like, it's, I'm glad we're having this conversation and that I really appreciate you bringing your, like, expertise on this subject today.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Well, everybody, please take a few minutes, an hour or two, but at least a few minutes, and visit wearestrongerthancensorship.org to see how you can get involved in the resistance against book bans. I should also bring up, once again, IBPA-online.org. That's the Independent Book Publishers Association. And again, Lee is the chief content officer over there. And then quickly, once more, just, you know, visit pen.org and read that report on the normalization of book banning so you can see what it is that we are all up against, because we are all in this together in the indie community. Let's help each other out. Let's help raise all of our voices up. And then finally, if you want to check out Lee's books, go to leewind.org. We can read more about the man himself and check out all of his books. Lee, It's been a pleasure just to chat with you again today. I say this every single week, but I'm going to say it again. I knew the conversation was going to go by in a blink, and it certainly did this time. So thanks again for your time and, you know, for carving out some minutes in your day to join us.
Absolutely. I really appreciate it. And for everyone listening, thanks for listening.
Yeah. And then for our viewers out there, yeah, what Lee just said, thank you for joining us week in and week out. And welcome to our new viewers out there. I saw a few new names out there today. So we appreciate you all. Just real quickly, a few housekeeping items. If y'all wouldn't mind sharing this episode, if you feel like you learned something from it, subscribing to Self-Published Insiders, it helps us attract guests like Lee to share their advice and expertise. If you want to see what our next topics will be and who our next guests will be, you can bookmark dddlive.com for just that purpose. And finally, if you are investigating the self-publishing waters, perhaps for the first time, you can sign up for a free Draft a Digital account simply by going to draft2digital.com. That brings us to the end of our episode. I want to thank our guests one last time, Lee. Yay! Thanks. I hope we get to see more of you in the upcoming year. I will try to make it to IBPA next May, is it?
Yes. The conference? It's going to be May 14 to 16, 2026 in Portland, Oregon.
Oh, okay. Okay. Fantastic. I will try to be there. Hang out backstage for a second. I'll meet you back there. And in the meantime, I'm going to play a quick commercial spot for DDD Print. Until next week, we'll see you all next time. Take
Bye,
care
everybody.
Now.
Ebooks are great, but there's just something about having your words in print. Something you can hold in your hands, put on a shelf, sign for a reader. That's why we created DDD Print, a print-on-demand service that was built for you. We have free, beautiful templates to give your book a pro look, and we can even convert your ebook cover into a full wraparound cover for print. So many options for you and your books. And you can get started right now at draft2digital.com. That's it for this week's Self-Publishing Insiders with Draft to Digital. Be sure to subscribe to us wherever you listen to podcasts and share the show with your will-be author friends. And start, build, and grow your own self-publishing career right now at draft2digital.com.